Christine.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you, Joe, about your political egalitarianism idea. There's something rather perverse that struck me about the project, which makes it interesting, but, well, not plausible, just in that I think when we think of political liberalism, it is produced as to address cultural pluralism or moral pluralism, disagreement on what a liberal society should be like. So we're all says what we should do is think of liberalism as detached from comprehensive liberalism, and we'll be able to have reasonable disagreement, and we'll be able to have consensus on this more restrictive notion. So I thought when I saw the title Political Egalitarianism, I thought that's really cool, that's neat to see this sort of echo of Rawls here, but I don't think you actually are doing the same thing in a way, because surely the controversy about egalitarianism is egalitarianism itself. That is, controversy about why should I give my money to somebody else to make them more equal to me. Isn't that what makes that the source of disagreement and controversy that egalitarians have to address, more than metaphysical questions about the nature of the person that undergirds various egalitarian debates?
I'm not sure how to respond to that. I mean the way you just formulated that suggested that the problem is, sort of, why should I give my money to someone else, making you a net loser and them a net gainer? And it seems to me that, yeah, it's difficult to motivate that, which is why I don't think political egalitarianism should countenance those types of transfers.
I put it very crudely, but why should wealth be redistributed more generally?
Right,
that's where the controversy lies, that we need a sort of consensus building move to go in, and that's why egalitarianism is the response, to try and make it seem plausible that some people are deserving.
I mean, as Elizabeth Anderson said, again, she said that luck egalitarians allowed themselves to get sidetracked from the political concerns of equality into questions of cosmic injustice. And I think that that's really true. I mean, there's some factors that push in that direction that were reasonable, some that weren't. But the discussion of equality got sidetracked into these sort of gigantic pictures of natural inequality and what to do about them, and so on and so forth. This is a legitimate discussion to be had there, but then you can't allow that to occlude the political discussion about what to do with the benefits of the system of cooperation that we have in place, the economy, and so forth. But it seems to me that, look, part of what's driving this is just, there is this huge disconnect between the philosophical literature and the world, right? David Miller said, that equality as such is a norm that appeals only to political fanatics and philosophers. That it's easy to lose track of just how incredibly demanding and strict equality is. Are you talking about equalizing your condition with that of someone else, right? Or when people talk about global distributive justice, and they're using norms of equality, like equalizing? I mean, that's like taking 99% of our GDP and shipping it off somewhere else, right? I mean, equalizing is incredibly strict and demanding. Yet there are circumstances where I think that's appropriate, like strict equalization. But it can't be, globally or even, domestically, that it could be a strict norm of equality that applies, right? So I think also the discussion of political philosophy has just gotten so disconnected from political reality, in part because we've allowed ourselves to become sort of overly concerned with these moral intuitions that come up. We say, you can't possibly, do that to Tiny Tim or something like that. And I think that, so that's why you need the partition of the discussion, where you have to separate off the kind of a political conception, which is the kind of stuff that you're going to try seriously to do, and then, the other stuff where you're going to tolerate more inequality.
Can I just add something there? Wouldn't you then, maybe paradoxically, in order to achieve the consensus that Rawls tried to achieve with political liberalism, end up perhaps being not anti or un-Rawlsian in terms of opting for a more perfectionist conception of equality, which you hinted might be possible under certain constraints? So the analogy is a fairly limited one. It's how do we get agreement on equality, just as Rawls wanted to get agreement on liberalism, but the response might not be very Rawlsian.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. It just seems to me that it, you know, it hasn't been tried. I mean, that is trying to develop a political conception of equality. You know, you are subject to some constraints, but you're also free from a lot of the problems that have really people have found quite discouraging in the literature. I mean, a lot of the arguments that people find knockdown against neutral conceptions of equality. I mean, a lot of people treat the adaptive preferences problem as like a knockdown objection to neutral egalitarianism. Right, so it allows you to avoid a lot of dead ends as well in the philosophical literature. So the project is easier in some respects as well.
I have the following people on the list in case I miss someone in the sea of hands. Oren, Dick, Daniel, Andrew, and Alan. So Oren and
I was wondering if you could clarify exactly what it is, what feature of a moral view it is that disqualifies it, in your view, from sort of participating in the political discussion. I want to turn to the like egalitarian example, even though you just said that, you know, maybe parts of that, because it does illuminate some things. So for instance, you could say that, you know, there's a problem with like egalitarianism with respect to political justification, right? Because it relies on lots of controversial notions of responsibility, causation, etc., right? But you could also say something a bit different. And maybe you could say other things as well, but at least these two things. So you could also say a second thing, which is that, so for instance, if you ask Jerry Cohen, right, why is it that we should prefer your basic like egalitarian principle over, say, libertarian, you know, principles of self-ownership? He's gonna say, well, it's just my brute sort of intuition that that's the right thing, and he actually says that, right? You could opt either way, and that's like a brute moral view. There are no other reasons for it, right? And everything else is just built on top of that, but that's like rock bottom. So I was wondering which one of these two is the problematic feature, because you could have obviously a very controversial view, which doesn't exactly have that structure of, okay, there's this rock-bottom intuition that's the basis for everything. So which one is it? Over something else?
Yeah, I'm not sure quite the right answer. I guess I want to put it the other way around. For me, it always seemed to me that the obvious motivation for an egalitarian position was a contractualist one, right? Namely, you're trying to get agreement. And, so you put some constraints on possible modalities. And one of the, you know, equality, various attempts to specify a norm of equality are often articulate a kind of no place switching constraint, right? So if you wind up with an outcome in which no one has an incentive to want to be in anyone else's shoes or anyone else's position, then, of course, anyone can always do better through some other arrangement that would arbitrarily privilege that person, but it would automatically generate a desire on the part of the other to switch places with you and so forth, right? So, you know, often, conceptions of equality pick out a single point in which no one has a positive incentive to accept it, but no one has a positive reason to want to opt for something else that doesn't automatically generate an objection, right? So there is this kind of really obvious contractualist argument to be made for egalitarian arrangements that applies in, unfortunately, however, a limited set of circumstances, right? But that is in particular to cooperative arrangements. But it provides, it seems to me, like, a very, very undemanding justification of a position that doesn't rely upon a brute appeal to intuition or moral intuition or something like that. Right? This is absolutely like pragmatic argument for it. And it seems to me that all other motivations for equality lack that characteristic. And so when someone is coming along and saying, you know, I just feel that it's really wrong for people, read the passages from Kant, right, where he says, you know, what we want ultimately is for virtue to be rewarded and so forth, right? Like, insofar as that conception motivates the view of luck that then motivates the egalitarian position, it seems to me that, well, there's the problem right there with the moral view. So the answer to the question is not that there's some specific feature of these moral views I think is wrong, it's just that the political conception that always struck me as, as sort of the obvious motivation for egalitarian arrangements has this feature that all the other ones seem to lack. Not that someone couldn't produce some kind of argument, but it seems to me so far no one has.
Yeah, this is a question for Stephen Masuda. And it seems to me, in very broad terms, you're kind of positioned and arguing against sort of the religious right with respect to defending sort of political liberalism and the public reason, I think. But I wonder how your position with respect to the perfectionist left, you know, or what you would say. I mean, so for instance, just to take you back to this we are deciding whether, I mean, faced with the issue of the proposal for same-sex marriage, we might abolish marriage altogether, right, as a way to get equality. But then there's a proposal that he likes, which is that we instead, we do have the state favoring a certain type of, you know, romantic or long-term commitment relationship, and then extending it same-sex and opposite-sex either way. But the arguments for that, and those, we can just separate the issue of reproduction. Suppose we're just, you know, if a heterosexual comes to a couple comes and says, we're not interested in reproduction, we're sterile, we've signed an agreement, we're not going to adopt, they can still get married, so you can imagine the same-sex stuff. So you can put the reproduction issues to the side. We're just thinking about, essentially, we're thinking about the state putting its thumb on the scale and being pro and cajoling in favor of long-term commitment. It's not clear what the answer to that is, but it's clearly going to be, you know, controversial but sensible ideals of the good to be able to proceed. You have to relax. The public reason has got to allow controversial but sensible and maybe correct ideas of the good. It's not clear what the outcome is. I don't know, it's quite delicate as to whether we want to favor marriage as, you know, you can decouple, you know, the benefits. You know, the marriage bundles a lot of things together. People, you know, imagine a woman who says, I'll have just a bunch of sexual partners and live with a long-term female friend, why can't the state right now? So I'm not sure what the outcome is, but a sensible discussion here is going to be on the, you know, it will be on the terrain, I think, as the perfectionist, liberal perfectionist egalitarian sees it. And if you're worried, well, look, but if we let arguments about friendship or why, you know, commitment is better than being a hermit, if we let that on the table, somehow we're open to the religious person who says, God forbade homosexuality. I mean, and that's on the table equally. It's just a matter of the numbers. I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, for one thing, the religious. I mean, these arguments are not remotely on par. The religious arguments, first of all, they are some straight revelation. They're mostly self-canceling, because for every person who says God commands X, you combine with somebody who says God commands not X. Even if some tradition, some version of Christianity or something, or post-Reformation Christianity, is agreed as a tradition, there's also this huge wave of philosophical argument, probably going back to the Middle Ages and critics of Thomas Aquinas, but certainly Hume down to John Mackey, which say that, look, there are big problems with arguments coming from this terrain. They come with a big dampener or a big asterisk on them. And lock those terms. This religious theological tradition is a contribution to public ethics, is a degenerating research program in moral science. It has been for hundreds of years. And so, I mean, I just don't see the puzzle that, look, if we want, you know, we're talking about ideal democratic deliberation. Of course, it may be, but you tend to run between ideal democratic deliberation and then sort of actual politics we might conduct in the United States today. But that's non-ideal theory, where we might be faced with an ill-disposed electorate, and we're talking about being a society that's unjust in various ways. There may be all kinds of things, you know, strategic one might want to do in that kind of environment to achieve one's goals as best one can. But first, I would think, just in ideal theory, let's think about what we're for, you know, abstracting from these particular, you know, constraints and, you know, for this culture and this time and with this elected. Just think about what we're for. And what's a sensible conversation about what we're for? I think that just sensibly, now, I don't know if you want to say it excludes the religious, but they just don't have much weight. But excluding or downgrading these, you know, theological revelation arguments, it's just that we can only do that if we rule out any kind of controversial notion. It just seems, I'm tone deaf to that. I'm just not hearing it.
I agree with everything you just said, so I think you are misconstrued.
I think you're wrong.
Okay, so, I very much agree. I said this morning, to Andrew, when it comes to marriage, there'll be goods that has to do with, you know, stability of relationships and so on that justify favoring marriage in some respect. Application of criminal law to activities outside of marriage is a completely different question, and we want to be, you know, quite leery about that. So I do agree that there are a variety of goods, better, ways of life that we can bring to bear in shaping an institution like that and providing some favor for it. We wouldn't want to design basic liberties to only allow such forms of life. I mean, we can favor within the framework of basic liberties without ruling other things out. But then, in terms of, I think what you may have been misinterpreting was you wanted to say that look, arguments that are simply based on revelation aren't going to count for much if they don't carry anything beyond that. And I do agree with that. I mean, if someone comes to us and says, God spoke to me, or I believe that God spoke to X, and that's the sole reason, that isn't a reason that the rest of us have any reason to credit. So you would have to have more than that in order to sort of be in the game for having a public reason. You'd have to be able to cite some general good that that we could discuss as a community. So I agreed with the particular. I did agree with the particulars, and I perhaps misstated the paper or misstated the summary. What my position was.
Daniel.
Am I?
It is your turn.
Okay.
This is a question that's elicited both by Stephen and by Joe's paper, and actually I'd be curious to hear what anybody on the panel has to say about it, which has to do with the relationship between, let's spell it out in Rawlsian terms, not that I want this to become an exercise in Rawlsian exegesis, which would be horribly boring, but just to fix ideas. There are two notions which were thrown around in the session, which are, one, the political, and then public reason. And my question has to do with thinking about the relationship between those two things. Now specifically in relation to Joe's paper, one often forgets, as the months and years since one has last picked up political liberalism sort of fade away, just how unpolitical Rawls' sense of the political actually is, right? It's not like Rawls is saying, I was wrong in theory of justice, we just have to get out there in the rough and tumble and convince people, whoever they may be, that the difference principle and the principle of equal liberty is the right thing. He's got a very constrained conception of the political. The political is basically what we can achieve an overlapping consensus over. An overlapping consensus not amongst persons, but amongst doctrines, first of all, these comprehensive conceptions of the good, which are almost like philosophical, you can imagine philosophical texts that we have to find, some theological texts that we have to find some kind of convergence over. And not all of them, right? Only the reasonable ones. Now, John Handel, if memory serves, wrote an article a few years ago about the different senses of the reasonable that are out there in Rawls's text. But there's at least some construals of the reasonable, according to which the reasonable turns out to be a very, very demanding, the people who get to come to the table, as it were, the texts that get invited to the table, are a fairly limited subset. In some construals, Rawls is almost saying that, will be construed as reasonable those around which an overlapping consensus around, guess what, my principles could be achieved. I mean, it's the difference principle is still hanging around there in political liberalism. He said that it's not going to have the same kind of constitutional status as the first principle, but it's still in there. So, to say that this is a political conception is really, it's political in a very, very specific and technical sense, which doesn't seem to me to be the one that you are interested in. You seem to be interested in something more like what we talk about when we talk about the political. Here are all these people, and some of them believe in, we read David Miller's stuff on Desert, and it turns out that despite what, 100,000 moral philosophers have written about Desert and how it should be completely expunged from the vocabulary of moral and political philosophy, 67% of people still think that Desert is a perfectly good way in which to think about the distribution of resources. So here are the people that we have to think about selling our ideas to, and how are we going to do that? And there it seems like stuff to do with public reason starts. We can't just say anything, right? I mean, we could. There are constraints on what can be said. I'm rambling a little bit, so I'm going to stop. Basically, I guess my question is what we mean by political the more constrained, very, very disciplined thing that Rawls actually means in political liberalism? Or is it something a little bit broader? And if it is that, that something broader? Have we quit, maybe there's some connection here with Dick Arneson's concerns. Have we in a way quit the terrain of political philosophy altogether to enter into the terrain of political advocacy? Perfectly interesting area, right? It's very interesting to me. It's something that I think political philosophy should actually be thinking about more. What are the ethics of public advocacy by people, the likes of us, who are trained in the fine art of rhetoric, et cetera, et cetera? I guess I'll stop there, but there are a couple of questions, first of all, to do with where this sits with respect to the Rawlsian conception of political, and if it is beyond the Rawlsian political conception of political, have we in a way departed from moral philosophy to enter something interesting but different to do more with political advocacy and real-life political rough and tumble?
Sorry, that was a little bit...
You want to stop?
Well, just... Values will be political insofar as they have some circulation in the public culture, and we can understand these values from many different philosophical and religious points of view. But it's also important that the arguments then constructed on the basis of these public values are justificatory. And in the first instance, what we're trying to do is construct a defensible, powerful position with respect to the status of abortion, for example, based on the resources of these public ideas. And we believe that the resources of the public ideas are adequate to arriving at and justifying a defensible view, the most defensible view. Now, we also hope that when it comes to the constitutional sentence, matters of basic justice and so on, that most defensible view will be capable of securing an overlapping consensus, but we're not committed to a particular kind of justice because it's the basis for an overlapping consensus. We hope that it will form the basis for an overlapping consensus, but the arguments are supposed to be genuinely justificatory. And then the overlapping consensus story is a story about how people can converge on an account of justice constructed out of materials in the public political culture, which are also justificatory, given a variety of different foundational views about religion. But it's not as though consensus is a requirement sort of built in at the beginning. It's more of a hope that that what looks like, on balance, the correct view or the best view might be capable of being an object of a consensus, even though we agree to disagree at a very foundational level. So I don't know. It does seem to me that there are special reasons for wanting to have very broad-based agreement with respect to the most fundamental principles of justice and so on, because those are the things that fix people's fundamental guarantees. We guarantee them a certain range of liberties, we guarantee them fundamental equality at that level. And that, I think, does allow for more open debate with respect to other sorts of goods at the level of public policy, laws that are more easily revised, some constraints of fair-mindedness, fair aggregation procedures, and so on, but that we can live with greater disagreement at the legislative level insofar as we've secured people's fundamental interests constitutionally, say. That doesn't mean that anything goes, and it doesn't mean that we don't want the law to be deliberative and deliberatively based on public values, but it does mean that we can introduce more, I think, perfectionist values at that stage, or betterist values anyway. They're not things that would just speak to perfection, but speak to better rather than worse lives. As long as we can present those values to others, we may not fully agree about the way they apply to particular public policy matters, but there's some scope for discretion with respect to legislation, as long as there are also some constraints of fair-mindedness, non-discrimination, and so on. But I would tend to interpret the values that are in play in deliberative democratic settings at the legislative stage as being somewhat more open, in part because the need for a broad consensus is not as intense, sort of substantively, at that level. I don't know if that's at all responsive.
It's sort of a point of agreement between us. It took me a little while to adjust to a lot of the discussion that was going on at this conference of people talking about the principle of neutrality as being a sort of direct principle of justice being applied by the state, because so that had been all the way I've been thinking about it. I mean, what makes me gravitate towards the political liberalism framework is the fact that Rawls thinks of it as a kind of higher order constraint in the political, as a higher order constraint on the formulation of principles of justice, right? But it's the principles of justice that you formulate, the theory of justice, that's going to do the work. And so the political is going to serve as a kind of constraint on the development of, like, you know, what kind of a theory should you develop, whether it should be freestanding and so forth, right? And I mean, and I don't have a clear view on that. It's, I mean, you know, I gravitate towards a very prudential, like Stephen, very prudential understanding of that. Like, it'd be a good idea to develop a theory that is sort of as acceptable as, you know, as widely as possible. You know, the theory itself would still have to be attractive, right? But, the political serves as a constraint when you're formulating that theory. And whether it gets sort of really nitty-gritty, I mean, it is useful to remember that, Rawls's ambition was to develop an alternative to the use of utilitarianism in bureaucracies, right? I mean, you know, the governments are still using cost-benefit analysis quite broadly in making decisions. And yet, there's, national differences have developed. So, for example, in the UK, they do cost-benefit analysis with a prioritarian weighting. So you break things down by income quintile, and you assign different weights to benefits to people in different quintiles and so on, right? So, I mean, the equality argument starts to percolate down, to the very low level of the way in which impact is assessed in terms of the way public money is spent and so forth. I mean, so, you want to get a political conception of justice at an ideal level, then you need to develop a second best, theory that's going to handle the fact that you're not anywhere near the ideal. And then you're going to want to develop an operationalizable version of it. But the fact that you have to have all those layers in your theory kind of insulates you from doing just nitty-gritty kind of political advocacy.
Andrew.
Question for Joe. I don't think I understood what you said about the public metric of value, because I thought you said that Dworkin had the right answer there, but with his clamshells, but a public metric of, the clamshells aren't public. Like, if you ask me, who's the worst off person in the room today, I had no idea based on clamshells. Whereas with Rawls, I would, right? I would say, well, something, in the initial formulation, something any rational person wants is a means to everything else, or, so its income is at least part of the index, and we can observe income. But so I didn't understand what about Dworkin. And then at the end, you said, if social cooperation is distributing welfare, well, then it's welfare. If social cooperation is distributing some concrete good, it's that concrete good. So could you just restate what your view of the public metric of value is in relation to Dworkin?
Yeah, it's in Dworkin, the system of prices is an index that's constructed for the purposes of equalizing endowments. Like, the reason you run the auction is to get a set of prices to emerge, so that then you can equalize everyone's endowments in terms of those prices. So it's public in the sense that, it's not in each individual's private valuation of it. The amount that you pay for something doesn't correspond to your own utility valuation of it, right?
Not something you can actually do. I mean, so right here and now, it's not something you can actually do and figure out who is. It's not the actual price system in present today.
No, it's not. And so, it's kind of a long story. The market in that case is a revelation mechanism, right? That is, it gives everyone incentive to truthfully reveal their preferences and then aggregates them so that you can actually then say how much welfare is foregone by a particular act of consumption. And so that's why it's a public metric of value. I mean, and he's using it. I mean, so the problem with Dworkin's use of it is that it only works, the price system only counts as a public metric of value from an egalitarian perspective if you start with an absolutely equal endowment, right? If everyone starts with 100 clamshells, then you wind up with a price, the prices can serve as a public metric of value. But if you start out with anything less than an equal endowment, then you don't actually get anything that serves as a metric of value. So it's not a very robust metric, but it does serve that purpose. Like, we look at the whole thing, like, after the auction's run, and, see, well, okay, what's been equalized here? All right, well, what's been equalized is that everyone has a bundle worth exactly 100 clamshells. That's what's been equalized.
What's
been equalized in terms of that metric.
Okay, what do you say to your bureaucrat, though? I mean, you were just talking about bureaucrats. The bureaucrat says, right, but I don't know who the worst off are. Tell me who the worst off are. I don't have clamshells.
You're asking me what I would do.
Point is, we need a political... It's a political egalitarianism. It has to have a metric of an equalizandum. And it's got to be one we can apply in the real world despite disagreement into real world problems. But it's not going to be clamshells.
Yeah, the second best problem is enormous. Dworkin doesn't appreciate how enormous the second best problem is. Envy freeness has a huge second best problem in that there's no such thing as a more or less envy free distribution. So you have to use some complicated technical and abstruse apparatus to rank states using an envy freeness standard. And it all requires enormous idealization. So you know, your second best problem is huge from that perspective. I grant that. So I don't have an answer to that. I mean, you know, but with cost-benefit analysis, for example, people use hypothetical valuation and so forth. I mean, there are a variety of ways of trying to skin that cat, all of which are imperfect, but they're attempts to. You also have to relax the normative criteria that Dworkin imposes. Like, the fact that you have to start with a strictly equal endowment for it to count, that's too strict for a workable form of egalitarianism.
So I had a question for Anthony and a quick question for Joe. So that your paper gives me a chance to ask a question about your book that I wanted to ask you for a while. So you say that neutrality is equal respect. According to neutrality is equal respect, the law shouldn't impose burdens on L's if it does so in some sense because they're L's, right? And the test of whether or not that's true is this counterfactual test. Would the law have been the same had the group that was burdened been some other group? So it seems to me that there are two problems with that, and as I recall, you mentioned both of them in a little bit later in the book, but not in the paper. So one is that it seems indeterminate because, let's say you compare the L's with the M's, you might say, well, the law would have been different. So that seems to be, tell you one thing, but then you compare the L's with the N's, and it would not have been different. So which is the relevant baseline? It depends on which group you choose, and it seems sort of arbitrary which group you choose. The other problem is, I think, more serious, and that's that it seems inconclusive, right? I mean, how do we know what would have happened had it been another group? It might have depended on very idiosyncratic features of the political process and of the officials and the experiences of the officials who are involved in that process. And you seem to, in the book, seem to say things like that when you're discussing the Thomas case, and you say, well, you didn't quite see how the judges arrived at the conclusion that they did, given the variety of different possibilities that were there. And so when I was reading the book, I took that to be almost, you were introducing this theory of neutrality kind of to show that you couldn't really go very far with it, and that it was sort of, it only becomes kind of a curiosity that gets put to the side because of these problems. But you didn't mention any of the problems in your paper today, so now I'm less sure whether I was interpreting the book. And if I can just quickly ask a very different question, and that is, it seemed to me that there's an asymmetry between political liberalism and political egalitarianism, in that in political liberalism, there is sort of an idea that there's a morally favored baseline that we have sort of a presumptive reason to want to favor, and that's a baseline in which people aren't being coerced, right? And so then you need to have particularly good and reasons of a certain kind in order to justify coercing them, and that's how you get into the project of needing a political theory of liberalism and needing public reasons. But when I think about egalitarianism, I have trouble thinking of what the sort of presumptive baseline would look like, right? Because it seems that any way of organizing the sort of ownership or use of external resources, or no way of organizing the ownership and use of external resources, seems obviously kind of privileged from the outset vis-a-vis any other. And so I just wonder whether you risk smuggling in some, by imposing these constraints of a political version of egalitarianism, whether you risk smuggling in a kind of presumptive preference for the status quo.
So the right question is not to, we have to look at what would have happened with various other groups in society, because that's the only way we have to assess the relevant counterfactual. But the relevant counterfactual is whether it would have happened if it hadn't been the L's that were involved. Now, that can be hard to tell, which is sort of the second point. And the Thomas stuff is in the version on the website. I just didn't read it, so I still think that how substantial how much those sorts of concessions mean that you can't do much work with this, I'm not entirely sure about. It was suggested that I was changing the subject, and I agree that to a certain extent I was trying to. However, I don't agree that this proposal isn't responsive to some of the concerns that have made people think that the other conversation was interesting. So that is the perfectionist conversation, and or the anti-perfectionist conversation. And I think it's the part of it that I think is valuable. So if it doesn't do much work, then that's fine. I think it does the work that can be done by neutrality as an ideal. And in general, just to make a point about the sort of the notion of politics involved, I think that a good deal of the literature on this sort of thing is literature by theorists who are in a way trying to take the politics out of politics. I don't think you can do that. So I would say, to the extent that these notions of neutrality are useful, they're useful in making the argument you can make against policies that they shouldn't be directed against people of particular identities, but I don't think you can get much more than that, and the rest is kind of going to be politics in the vulgar sense.
I have to say, the way you formulated the issue with liberalism in terms of coercion, it simply never occurred to me. I'd never thought of it that way, and I don't see any reason to start. I just never thought of it that way. The relationship between this and political liberalism is political liberalism, you know, liberalism is, you know, society is a cooperative venture for mutual advantage governed by a theory of justice, right? And the theory of justice is going to tell you, you know, sort of on the mutual interest axis how much to produce, and on the conflict axis sort of how to distribute out the benefits and burdens of cooperation. And, you know, so you can have an efficiency principle and equality principle in the theory of justice. That'd be the most sort of bare bones theory of justice. And that's the blueprint from the first 5 pages of theory of justice. And, you know, the difference principle is a particular proposal for, you know, a kind of hybrid notion that's gonna, you know, that's gonna tell you when and how much to trade off efficiency against equality. But I've actually never met, I never met Rawls, right? So I've never met anyone who bought the difference principle. And it strikes me a lot of does anyone like say, yes, difference principle? I've never met anyone who accepts it. So it seems to me a lot of the egalitarian literature is motivated by an attempt to produce a more plausible account of how you're going to, what your principles are going to be that's going to do the work of picking out the modalities of cooperation. That's how I understand the egalitarian literature. So, you know, the political egalitarianism is just a sub-project of attempting to develop a theory of justice that's suitable for, you know, a political liberalism.
Final question?
Yeah. My name's Chris Lowry. My question is pretty much a slight, maybe even not even a slight modification of Daniel's question. So Rawls makes a distinction, it can be either of you, if you have interest in answering the question. Rawls makes a distinction between his sort of technical use of the term political and uses the phrase political in the wrong way. It's a phrase that doesn't get talked about that much in the literature. I'm wondering whether what you think about this distinction, what it means by political in the wrong way, whether it's a useful distinction, and what, if any, role it plays in your papers.
I don't remember the specific context in which he says political in the wrong way. I mean, it would be political in the wrong way if it were thought to be not moral. I mean, it's a certain sort of moral concern. It's an appropriate sort of moral concern among citizens thinking about the use of political power and so on. But I don't remember the specific context of what he's referring to.
Mere
modus vivendi, okay. So, that would be the view that we're just looking for some sort of terms of cooperation without any principled basis. And it could be also the view that there's no sort of moral account as to why we should settle on this particular mode of interaction. We leave morality to maybe to the particular communities that constitute the society, and our mode of interaction in politics is just a compromise, a mere compromise, or a settlement without any kind of moral grounding. So I take it to be the Rawls's political view, properly understood, to be the view that there's a distinctive way of thinking about our political obligations to one another as citizens that are genuine moral obligations. It's the best way of thinking about our moral obligations to each other as citizens in a pluralistic society caracterized by reasonable pluralism. This is the best moral view. It's not moving away from the realm of morality. It's rather the most powerful account of what our moral obligations are to one another as citizens, given the fact of reasonable pluralism.
To the extent that in your paper you talked about the importance of public reason for constitutional essentials of basic justice, but then once they're secure, there was a talk about sort of a rough and tumble, or actual like sort of ordinary sense political stuff going on for the rest of it. Do you think that could be described as politically in this slightly not as morally grounded principle kind of way, but more a balance of power kind of way of talking about it. Would you
want
to resist that characterization?
Yeah, I would want to resist that characterization. I think what I said was that deliberative Democrats like Gutman and Thompson claim to be distinguishing themselves from Rawls, and it doesn't seem to be they really are. But perhaps they're allowing that within the realm of what I said before, legislative deliberation, as certain things have been settled, we might admit a wider array of claims about what's good for people that then would be appropriate when shaping the most fundamental principles of justice that secure people's fundamental interests. That's what I was suggesting. That doesn't mean it's all rough and tumble or everything goes at all. We still want to make claims about better and worse ways of life that could be submitted to democratic discussion, that could be backed up by ordinary means of proof and evidence and so on, including the sort of advantages for marriage in terms of health and well-being and the satisfactions of stable long-term relationships that we might accidentally discount in short-term temptation and so on. So all those things would be admissible. And more of that would be admissible at the legislative stage than would be properly admissible when we're thinking about what should be enshrined in the Constitution. If a thicker account, and including spending money on opera houses and encouraging appreciation for the arts and so on, we sort of permit that at the constitutional stage. We don't necessarily build it into. We don't necessarily build in that sort of thing at the constitutional stage. At least that's said. But it doesn't mean everything goes and it's all rough and tumble.
Quick comment because we're.
Hi, my name is Chris Durante. My question is for Stephen Macedo. I'll make it quick. You spoke about Stout, and you didn't make the claim, but you kind of implied he's kind of flip-flopping. It was on his idea of public reason.
I think he's flip-flopping.
I'll refrain at the moment because it's supposed to be quick for my defense of Stout. But must public reason be construed in terms of espousing reasons or putting forth your mode of reasoning? I work on issues of religious pluralism. So does the public necessarily have to accept the premises of a religious person, or can a religious person espouse their premises from their sect, their belief system, so long as their mode of reasoning that they employ after doing so is accessible to the public? To put it in a nutshell and make it quick.
I mean, it depends on what you mean by accessible to the public. When someone refers to the literal truth of the Bible, their belief, their faith in the literal truth of the Bible, and in some ways that claim is accessible. I know what they're saying, roughly speaking. I just don't, they're not giving any ground to accept it. There's no public ground to accept it. But this is some claim of faith rather than of proof based on common evidence and so on. So the accessibility point, I mean, it depends on what one means by accessibility. Stout does have this model of iterative dialogue, which I think is what he calls it, that if we went around sort of on a one-on-one basis, we could sort of put our sort of comprehensive frameworks on the table and we could discuss them. And he seems to have a model of open-ended discussion in civil society that would involve this sort of open-ended iterative dialogue among people with all of their beliefs in play and so on. I mean, and the problem is that looks like a nice model of sort of civil society conversation, including building bridges across faith communities that might differ on various things. But if we're thinking about justifying constitutional essentials in a large and diverse polity, there may not be time for that. And the resources that might go into certain kinds of negotiation might not be appropriate. And at the end of the day, too, we need to settle on arrangements that are going to be imposed on people. So I think the other thing that Stout tends to do sometimes is to not focus on the moment of decision and the moment of decision on fundamental political matters that are going to be imposed on people, because we need to arrange our institutions one way rather than another. And before we've exhausted all of the conversations we might have about each other's fundamental premises about religious matters and so on. So I do think that Stout waffles, and I think he both acknowledges and objects to the sort of model of public reason, and I think in part he surely doesn't mean to discount the idea that the democratic community has its own distinctive values and virtues. He affirms that in the book. And yet he also wants to agree with Nicholas Woltersdorf that there's something second rate about that sort of political communitarianism, and that there's something wrong if that account of shared virtues and shared values that emerge from the framework of a public community impose constraints on more particular religious and ethical communities within that framework. And I just don't see how you can have it both ways. So I think he does want to have it both ways, and I don't think he's entirely worked out his view in that book.
Well, we should conclude by thanking our speakers who are very